From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Parent. The claim by the Papua New Guinea government that the country's immediate economic future is looking rosy is being challenged. In its budget release last Tuesday, the PNG government predicted significant growth and a substantial lift in earnings. The Treasurer, Charles Abel, said the budget is aimed at ensuring a broad-based resilient economy, that is, that can withstand the volatility brought by economic and environmental disruptions. But economist Paul Flanagan, who has long followed PNG's economic fortunes, told Don Wiseman the government has taken some big risks in its projections.
The government and the budget is painting quite an upbeat picture. Not only over the next year, but if you look out over the course of the 5 years, their projections are of very, very strong growth in the economy. Like, they've got numbers of the economy growing by close to 10% by 2022. So this is a very, very upbeat assessment as to how the PNG economy is going. And in that context, they feel as if they can rapidly increase both expenditure, because they believe they'll be getting a lot more revenue.
Can they justify that?
So the language is good. The language looks like that. But when you start looking at some of the numbers, unfortunately, there are some serious concerns. So those upbeat numbers on the economy, those numbers disagree with their own National Statistics Office. Their starting point in 2015, which the government should have incorporated into the projections, is actually 10% less. The numbers that they're incorporating, as I say, like to be including figures of near 10% on growth, is quite risky, because what you do then is you start pushing up your expected levels of revenue. And when you push up your revenue, there's a tendency for government to spend that money. And the question is whether that money has been well spent in PNG.
In terms of inflating projected growth, Papua New Guinea's been down this road so recently and it didn't happen. Doesn't seem to have been a lesson learned there.
So that's a lesson from, you know, just a few years ago. What's even more extraordinary is in the agreement that Papua New Guinea had with, let's say, the World Bank to get the budget support. 2 months ago, in the 2019 budget strategy, Treasurer Abel indicated they expected the actual, what they're using as the deficit measure now, would be some $592 million. This budget indicates that's blown out to over 1,500 million kina. So they've had $1 billion revenue in their resource sector in the last few months. They were supposed to save that, but instead they've gone and spent it. So contrary to agreements with the World Bank and others that they would try and save any resource windfalls, to get out of this boom and bust cycle that they've seen before, they've decided to go and start spending those funds. So this is a very risky strategy, especially with a very upbeat view of the economy.
We know that right across government departments in PNG, they've struggled. Education and health. There's a significantly more money for education. Is it enough to pull them out of those problems?
So actually, looking at the figures, there has been a small increase in education, just enough to cover off the expected inflationary impacts. Health has actually gone back slightly. And if you compare budgets from 2015 to 2019 and allow for the impacts of inflation, then areas such as education have actually been cut by nearly 30%. I think it's about 17% cut for health.
That is not how the government's representing it, though.
No, and the big gainers from this particular budget is, number one, there has been a very significant increase in infrastructure spending, which is a positive thing if it's done well. There have been some additional finances going to support sort of water and energy, and that can be done. That's positive if done well. But the other big winner, by far the largest winner in sort of Kenya terms, is the administrative sector. And this potentially reflects a very interesting power shift, because the electoral funding that had gone to local MPs and to the provinces, these programs called the DSIP programs, had been moved from the provinces to one of the departments, the Department of Implementation and Rural Development. That represents a significant power shift within PNG.
All right. So overall, is this budget going to achieve what the government hopes it might achieve?
It's a risky budget. You'd have to describe it as a risky budget. They've bet once again that this resource boom they're going through at the moment will continue. And they're betting on the fact that they have in part broken trust with the people who have just provided them with budget support. They received $500 million in a sovereign bond raising 2 months ago. So when they went out to investors and asked for these funds, they would have been using these figures as to that they were a fiscally responsible government. They were winding back the deficits. They were going to be careful with any resource revenues they received. And the message of this budget is, unfortunately, they're pretty inclined to just go and spend it.
So in terms of the opportunities for seeking more foreign investment, they're lessened as a result of this budget?
Yeah, the lesson is a result of this budget, and there's not enough done in this budget to deal with, let's say, the exchange rate problems that are being faced. So as an investor into PNG, you'd have to think very carefully. Unless the exchange rate is fixed, the moment if you do make a profit, it's very difficult to get those dividends and that profit back out again. There are some real challenges that they're going to APEC talking up trade possibilities, but they've got to do harder yards to actually get those policies put in place.
A candidate from last year's PNG's general election is urging the country to adopt a national ID-based voting system before the next poll. Di Kawanu, a former MP for Mendi in Southern Highlands, lost his seat in the election to Government Minister Michael Nally. However, due to frustrations over irregularities in the election, the province was plagued by bouts of violent unrest well into the middle of this year. Mr. Kawanu told Johnny Blaze that many people were denied a fair vote due to practices such as block voting, while misusing the ghost names on electoral roll was rife.
Mathematically, if you see it, how can you have 100% turnout in an election? It's impossible. So why is every ward you have 100% turnout? The only conclusion is that it's been rigged. It's the presiding officer and the election official that sign and initials at the back, and they sit in a row and they just do that. And people just mind their own business, and few individuals go through and do what they did.
You know, you've obviously been in a few elections, and do you think this is getting worse in PNG elections?
This thing will get even worse if we don't improve the system by getting this NID registration going. You have an ID card, meaning that you could vote using your card and your fingerprints and all that. That will change the election system in the country. Unless and until we have the first past the post and the preferential. Preferential is the one that we have now. We used to have the first past the post, but the current parliament is trying to bring back the first past the post.
Do you agree with that?
I can only agree if the system changes. System meaning that the method, meaning that everyone votes with fingerprints and with your national identification card. You have a card, you vote. You have your fingerprints done now. You have a vote. So the government has spent enough money to have the system right. People have ghost names in common rolls. If you have ghost names, and people who have been winning and quietly coming year in, year out, election in, election out, they've been maintaining those votes, and they were doing block votes and basically rigging all this time. Those kind of MPs wouldn't probably want a racist change. But that may be few. But if the majority wants it, then we will have a better election outcome, and we will have a better system in the country in terms of reliable data.
In your province, there's just been a lot of unrest in the last year, all because of this election results and the perception that they were rigged. I mean, is that perception widespread?
You mean in the province?
Yeah.
Yeah, to an extent, it's just people were frustrated because the outcome was not the way they anticipated, given the fact that they didn't go for elimination. I mean, how can you come calculate 50 plus 1 and declare a winner without going to the extent that the quality checks are done? And they haven't even gone to eliminations. They haven't even started.
An epidemiologist at American Samoa's Department of Health says he's confident the territory's 18-month-long dengue outbreak is coming to an end. Dr. Afifi Tuluf says the outbreak was first declared when some tuna cannery workers became ill in March 2017, and he thinks it came into the country from a Solomon Islands fisherman. Since there have been 1,009 confirmed cases of dengue 2 serotype, with 761 people receiving brief hospital treatment for the illness, such as intravenous fluids. told Jenny Meyer, there have not been any confirmed dengue cases in the past 6 months, and the government has done a lot to contain the viral illness, which is spread by mosquitoes.
As far as containing the dengue outbreak here, our environmental health division here at Department of Health, we're very active with trying to do some source reduction with vector control, informing the public, having teams go out to the public and letting them know about some education about where mosquitoes might be breeding. We've also gotten to the point where the teams go out and giving citations to businesses and families who are not abiding by the different laws here that with regards to keeping the outside of your houses cleaned and things like that. So vector control, and also we've gone out to spray at local schools and different businesses and different office locations here in American Samoa. We've also sent teams out to the outer islands of Manua. We've also contacted CDC, who brought down the team to go around, and we've done serial surveillance just to get a good idea of, you know, how fast the virus is spreading and how extensive it has spread, so that we can guide our vector control teams to go out there and inform the public, educate them, and also assist with source reduction.
So what's your feeling with the trend for dengue 2 at the moment in American Samoa? Do you think, are you expecting these numbers to grow, or do you feel like you're on top of it? The rainy season is approaching. What are your thoughts about the trend?
Yeah, I have a good feeling about the trend here. I think we've got a really good control. One of the challenges that I would say right now is because, you know, we have many flights that go out to the neighboring independent state of Samoa, and the virus can travel back and forth. But our teams are also present there at different ports to try to maintain that as well. The challenge still persists. As far as the outbreak here, it peaked about December of 2017, January of 2018, and then we've seen a downward trend since that point on. And for the entire month of October, we have not seen any more positive cases. So at this point, we are actually giving it just one or two more weeks of observing this trend going on of no positive cases. And if it continues by the end of this week, we're probably going to call the outbreak over.
And you are listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. Transparency Solomon Islands says a recent spat of arrests and convictions for corruption is welcome. Last week, the MP, Dixon Mua, was arrested and charged for misusing a shipping grant. The police commissioner, Matthew Vari, says 10 other MPs were also under investigation. Then on Monday, the former permanent secretary of the police ministry, Edmund Skua, was convicted on 3 corruption charges. Transparency's Ruth Likola says this is welcome news, but she told Jamie Tahana that the election's looming. That means more work needs to be done.
People are becoming more and more aware of the fact that it is okay for them to speak up and be heard and to report to the police of corrupt conducts that they observe in the MP or the non-delivery of the development that is expected from the millions that have been disbursed in the name of Constituency Development Fund through the members of parliament.
So people are actually reporting more, are they? Are we seeing an increase?
People are actually reporting and working with the police on that. Previously, they didn't know that this Constituency Development Fund belongs to them or is given to, for the development of the constituency and to raise the standard of living within the constituency, as well as encourage income generation. And at the same time, too, that they didn't know how much is involved. In their view, it's only 300,000 and not worth talking about. But when they actually are told that this is in millions, then they are now starting to ask questions and working with police to follow where the money goes. The power is vested with the people in this country. So if there are decisions or if there are mismanagements of public funds and all of that, the voters or the constituencies have the right to raise questions and to demand for accountable and transparent manner in which the millions have been spent.
So there's still a fair way to go, isn't there? And does the whole constituency fund thing need to change?
Yes. I mean, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing and all of that, I think first and foremost, this Constituency Development Fund is influencing everything that we do and the manner in which people are deciding to vote. We hear about the cross-border voting. People are trying to make as much money as they can. And for us in TSI, the role of the parliamentarians is to make legislation. And what is happening now with the Constituency Development Fund is truly unconstitutional under our current constitution.
But you've got an election coming soon, so there's been a good week in terms of arrests and convictions. But in a few months, they're going to be going around the provinces promising and dishing out cash here and there again, aren't they? I guess, what are you expecting in the next few months as we come to election time again?
There will be. I think we need to have a very active civil society voice in order to help in holding the leaders that we elect accountable to the people and be truly the voice of the people.
An analyst of Pacific Issues says New Zealand and Australia are turning deaf on their ears on calls for more independent media in the region. Both countries have rolled out new funding as part of their Pacific Reset and Step Up initiatives, including more support to media in the Pacific. On Thursday, Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison said his government would expand Australian commercial TV into the Pacific. And earlier this month, RNZ Pacific revealed New Zealand will use a new dedicated TV channel for the Pacific to promote its investment in the region. Analyst Tess Newton-Kane of TNC Consulting told Mackenzie Smith that neither plan was answering calls from the Pacific.
So what we've seen from New Zealand was, first of all, we saw an allocation of funding to increase broadcasting to the region. And that was then followed by an announcement that one of the things that that broadcasting would be used for would be telling the New Zealand government story about how it operates in the region and what it does in terms of development. And that obviously starts to set off a few warning bells, because there's a very fine line between editorial independent and politically independent broadcasting that is designed to inform and educate or entertain, and something that could quite easily look like government propaganda. On the other side of things, what we heard from Prime Minister Morrison yesterday about his thinking in terms of Australian broadcasting, which I understand goes against the current advice he's received from DFAT, is that what he's been talking to commercial providers about sharing content or providing content to Pacific media outlets that draws on things like lifestyle and entertainment programs. He was a bit ambiguous about whether it would include sports coverage. And that seems to go against what we're hearing from the region, which is what people want is they want stuff that's politically and editorial independent. They want good quality news and current affairs coverage, and they want content that is tailored to them as a specific audience.
So you say then that in Australia's case, it goes against official advice, and in both New Zealand and Australia's case, it goes against the interests of the Pacific. Why then are these two countries pursuing this kind of media effort?
Part of the reason they're pursuing it is that they see it as a gap in their engagement with the region. Both countries have recognised that they need to change the way they view their relationships with the Pacific. I don't think they're doing it the same in both cases. So both want to be seen to be doing more. Both want to be seen to be doing better. Both are concerned about influences from elsewhere, including what are sometimes called soft power influences, which is where broadcasting may fit, although it isn't necessarily the best fit for it. So I think that's what's driving this. In terms of where the misalignment is, I think it's because, you know, people are being advised by all sorts of different people, and it would appear that some voices are being heard louder than others. But what we need to know is that voices of the Pacific are being heard in this. The Prime Minister of Vanuatu said quite clearly, what we want is shortwave radio broadcasting because it saves lives. So he's not the only voice, but he's a very clear voice coming from the region saying, we know what we want and need. We want independent, good quality news and current affairs, and we want it delivered via shortwave radio. So commercial TV of lifestyle makeover shows and reality sagas is not what's been asked for. And so, you know, essentially that is a product that someone's trying to sell for which there does not appear to be a market.
There are questions in Papua New Guinea around the affordable majority of new infrastructure projects being developed with China. PNG's government recently announced the 900 million Ramu 2 hydropower project will be led by a Chinese company, Shenzhen Energy Group. This month, the government also confirmed Exim Bank of China would finance the construction of $200 million domestic submarine cable project. The executive director of PNG's Institute of National Affairs, Paul Baker, told Johnny Blades there are questions related to how sustainable the projects are and the costs entailed. Mr. Baker began by discussing the hydropower project.
It's basically downstream, so it's using the waters coming out from the Ramu. Existing Ramu Dam, and as they drop down into that basin, into the valley below. So yes, it is connected, and it would utilize the same grid, although the grid would probably have to be, they already upgraded the grid a decade and a half ago, but never completed the job. So there would need to be work done on that. But I suppose the question really comes is they have had that plan for a long time. They did go out to tender, you know, whether that was a genuine, fully competitive tender. And so, one, is it a competitive bid? Is the whole project competitive? And did the company that won really put in a competitive bid? Yes, it did win, but, you know, is that really going to be a price that would be affordable and sustainable? Because the issue is, power in PNG is pretty costly, and it's pretty unreliable, and it's pretty unavailable. So the aim is to make sure power is available, affordable, and reliable, and that the power provider, PNG Power, can actually make money and not lose money in the whole process. And so PNG Power certainly was pretty concerned about this project, I understand, when they were looking at it earlier, because they really do need to be refocusing on power sources where the power is available at an affordable price. The capital cost burden is not going to drag them down into decades, because PNG Power is undercapitalized. It's near insolvent, probably is insolvent, despite the fact that it's been declaring so-called profits and handing dividends to the government. You have to say it would be pretty well at or close to insolvency, and it really needs to be able to address the bottom line, which is to ensure that it has a viable business and has the funds to be able to do its basic tasks of maintenance and upgrade and provision of reliable service to its clients.
Do you see any significance in the Ramu hydropower projects being billed as a public-private partnership? Well, that's at least according to Shenzhen's president.
Yeah, we've had build, own, operate type plants in the past, and it is a mechanism to reduce the sort of the immediate burden on the local provider. There's some merit in that, but it depends really on the bottom line and how it's negotiated and who is really sharing and carrying the costs. And some of the deals that we've had in the past, including the arrangement here in Moresby for providing power out of the Kanudi oil plant, really added to the costs considerably of power provision. and really was a disadvantage. I mean, it did provide power, which was needed, but it was certainly not the best option. And so it really depends on how those things are negotiated and how the balance and whether PNG Power is really having to sort of carry a disproportionate burden of the actual costs.
There's another big infrastructure project which a Chinese company is involved in PNG, in the cable, the domestic component to a big new project. You know, this is China's company Huawei involved. This is going ahead, isn't it, Paul?
Yeah, well, I understand, again, projects are agreed. I understand that the government is actually sort of, or its business arm has been drawing funds down for that project. It's a pretty extensive domestic network going, stretching around the coast to the different centres, linking them into PNG broadband, as it were, network. Again, the real question is, at what cost is this affordable? Obviously, you've had domestic, well, businesses that have been installing different options, including use of satellite, lower orbital satellite technology, that have been providing improved internet access in different places around the country. This will clearly undermine and compete with them, but then the state service provider and the government, which will presumably be providing a sovereign guarantee on this, on the debt, it's whether it is what PNG needs, whether it's an appropriate, affordable model for a developing country that's really struggling financially and has been experiencing pretty tough economic times for the last many years, whether PNG is obtaining an appropriate model, or whether it's a model that is really a step too far, is too expensive, and is just further posing debt on PNG and the citizens.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Thank you for joining us. We'll see you again in 7 days' time. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, saying so long and take care. Bye-bye.